Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a name. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just?
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name's Noah, and I'm one of your hosts for today's show. Today we're dedicating our entire show to airing parts of a recent talk given by members of the group of former political prisoners known as the Angola Three. For those unfamiliar with the Angola Three, they are three African-American men, Herman Wallace, Robert King, and Albert Woodfox, who were sent to prison in 1971 in one of the most violent detention facilities in the United States. Members of the Black Panther Party, they fought to defend prisoners' rights while inside, as well as after their release. Herman Wallace died immediately after his release in October 2013. Robert King was released in 2001, and Albert Woodfox was released in 2016. As we announced on our last show, Robert King spoke recently in Montreal. Albert Woodfox had also been scheduled to speak at that talk, but was unable to make it due to travel complications. The audio you'll hear on today's show is from the talk that took place last Friday, March 17th, at Concordia University in Montreal.
So thank you, everybody, for coming, and thanks a lot to the organizers for putting this on. First, I just want to hear a round of applause for Robert King, who's here with us today. I really just want to thank you on behalf of everybody here and everybody that couldn't make it here, just for the decades and decades of courageous activism that you've undertaken on behalf of, I think, what we all think is for Black people everywhere. So to begin, I will just introduce a little bit the case of the Angola Three, who are three political prisoners who have been placed in solitary confinement in for a lot of the time in the Louisiana State Penitentiary that is known as the Angola Prison, beginning in April 1972. So Albert Woodfox is a Black Panther activist and ex-political prisoner who was released in February 2016 at the age of 69 after having been detained and tortured for 45 years in the Angola Penitentiary. Of which 43 years of those were spent in solitary confinement. No American prisoner has ever been put in solitary confinement for so long, and this cruel and unusual punishment was inflicted on him because he was Black and because of his political beliefs and because of his political organizing in prison. With Herman Wallace and Robert King, Albert Woodfox was part of the Angola, a group we now call the Angola Three, who have been held in one of the most violent detention facilities in the United States. Robert King, on my left, stayed in Angola for 32 years, and he spent 29 of those years in solitary. From the time he came out in 2001, he's been active outside. They were already active, all of them, really powerful activism from inside of prison. But since he got out in 2001, he's been fighting to free his two friends. Herman Wallace was released in 2013, but unfortunately, he died just a few days later. He died a free man, but he died just a few days after he was released. And since Woodfox recovered his freedom in February 2016, he's been traveling all over Europe and the United States with Robert King to advocate for the abolition of solitary confinement and to free all political prisoners. So I'll just give a little bit of a background on the case before we go over to you. In deep rural Louisiana, there was three young Black men who were imprisoned and trying to be active around continued violence and segregation and the really horrific abuse that was taking place in what is the largest prison in the United States, an 18,000-acre former slave plantation that had been called Angola. I think the history, particularly of this prison, is the history really of all American prisons, which we know is really the direct lineage of slavery. The fact that this is a slave plantation corresponds to just the larger, really direct, the fact that incarceration, especially black incarceration in the U.S., is really directly following his since the abolition of slavery, really since the 13th Amendment, we've seen a direct targeting and forced labor of black Americans, in particular, behind bars. So Wallace and Woodfox had founded a prison chapter of the Black Panther Party and organized inmate protests against conditions at the facility and were actually punished for doing so. These three prisoners ended up held in solitary confinement, charged falsely with a murder that they did not commit. And that, at that moment, they were put into 6'9" solitary cells where they actually remained for decades as punishment for their organizing as just politicized prisoners. This was actually part of a larger movement that I think we all know of really punishing black Americans for speaking out against injustice. We all know about the story of Angela Davis. This happened to Assata Shakur. There were so many other acts of police falsely charging people, of people forced to really spend enormous times of their life behind bars. A lot of political activism at the time ended up just spending its energy diverted into trying to get activists out of prison. In 2000, Herman, Albert, and Robert filed a civil lawsuit challenging the inhumane and increasingly punitive, pervasive practice of long-term solitary confinement. And the magistrate judge described their decades of isolation as so far beyond the pale she could not find anything even remotely comparable in the annals of American jurisprudence. But that wasn't the end. The struggle for justice continued until Robert was released in 2001, Herman in 2013, and Albert in 2016. The state's case against them is riddled with inconsistencies and missteps. There is a bloody print at the murder scene that didn't match Albert, Herman, or anyone charged with the crime. And it was never even compared with the other prisoners who'd had access to the dorm on the day of the murder. There was DNA evidence that was lost by prison officials, including fingernail scrapings from the victim. I mean, this case is one of so many others in terms of just false evidence of really just, you know, trumping up charges in order to punish black people for bravely stepping up. So I think I'll just pass the mic to you now to let you continue telling your story.
I'm glad I'm able to be here. I won't bore you with a whole lot of details. Some of you who have read our case know about that of the Angola 3, which only highlights the injustices that take place within the criminal justice system in the United States of America, and especially in Louisiana. But as Robin pointed out, I was initially charged with an armed robbery in which they offered me a 35-year sentence. I had had a prison sentence. They offered me a 35-year sentence, and I refused to take 35 years. Rather, they offered me a 15-year sentence if I pled guilty to this particular crime. Having a record, it automatically make you guilty of aiding and abetting any other crime that's committed, especially if this crime has not been solved. That was a method they used to have. They call cleaning the books on individuals. It was the police, the practice of the police, that if you were black, and by the way, I'm a post-World War II baby. We go way back. These were the times, and of course, those times are similar now. But if you was a black man during that time, any crime that was committed within a vicinity or parameter in which you were subject, you were guilt, especially if the identification of the perpetrator was a black male, you automatically became a suspect. And if you had a criminal record, then this magnified that possibility of you being arrested for this crime and charged. Well, it was such a case that had happened, it replicated itself thousands of times in the States. And it so happened with me at the time. They offered me a crime had been committed, and they offered me a 15-year sentence if I pled guilty to the crime. I couldn't afford a lawyer, and the practice of the state is they appoint you a lawyer who have the obligation to bring you to trial only, not any money to uncover evidence, favorable evidence, you know. The idea is to bring you to trial, give you, quote, what they call due process. And once you got due process, you know, it doesn't matter. The law has been satisfied according to, you know, the legal jargon of legality. It has been satisfied. In other words, they wanted me to plead guilty to a 15-year sentence. I did not do this. If the sentence would have been less, being placed in a position once before to have to cop out or plead guilty to a crime I hadn't committed, if they would have said, if the offer would have been 5 years, I would have gladly took the 5 years, even though I was innocent of that particular crime. It was an armed robbery crime. I would have taken it because if I went to trial, took a chance of going to trial, I figured my chance of being found guilty because an all-white jury, you know, even though the Constitution states that you're, when you go to trial, you have a jury of your peers, and I use that in quotation, a jury of your peers. You really don't have a jury of your peers. You have a jury at the time it was constructed, made up strictly of white males mostly. Maybe it might throw a white female every now and then, but it was mostly white males, and you would go to trial and you would be found automatically guilty of a crime. And it wasn't so much as a unanimous decision. It was if 10 people found you guilty and 2 say, no, absolutely not guilty, you were guilty anyway, because a majority, as they say, rule within that judicial district. And in a 10-2 verdict, I elected to go to trial. And because they all say, take 15 years, and I would not take 15 years. I had recently married. I thought I was going to be the middleweight champ of the world at one time. I had a son along the way, and he had recently been born, and I decided to just go ahead and you know, stick to my guns. I had a job working in an auto body and paint shop, doing paint, which was harmful to what I was trying to do anyway. In any event, I decided not to make a long story short. I decided to go to trial. I elected to take my chances going to trial, and I was found guilty in a verdict of 10-2. And they gave me a 35-year sentence. And it was at that time that I began looking at the system a different way. I was not, you know, educated to the aspect of the system. I did not know anything about the legal system, especially the legal judicial system. I noticed that you went to trial, you went to court, it was a jury. But I didn't understand the mechanism of all this. But in any event, I went to trial, and I was found guilty in a 10-2 verdict. And it was at that time I began to look at things differently. And at the same time, the emergence of the Black Panther Party came on the set around. Of course, I was familiar with Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad and all of them. And while I loved the thing that Malcolm was saying, it just wasn't my language at the time. I just had not embraced the facts of America, the process of America in dealing with its what America called its minority. Of course, Malcolm put that in context, say that we weren't in the minority when you look at it from a world scale. But this is what this is what happened in that process. In any event, I knew Malcolm. You know, and the thing that he said was pretty decent, but he articulated some things that I couldn't articulate. But I while being impressed with it, I wasn't attracted by it. It wasn't until the Black Panther Party said it that I became attracted by what they were saying, or what was being said, because the Black Panther Party came with a 10-point program. Not that Malcolm didn't have a plan. He was killed, most likely. He was murdered before he was able to construct an organization that would deal with people generally. But the Black Panther Party had a 10-point program, and I really loved that program. And while I was not a member of the Black Panther Party, I was attracted by it, because when they say we want freedom, power to determine our destiny, that was what I wanted. I wanted some freedom. I had went, you know, I was arrested on a charge, brought to trial, found guilty, offered a lesser sentence, found guilty by a jury of my quote peers, and I was given a 35-year sentence. So the only thing that I could do was do some introspection about myself, because at the time I didn't know what that was, but I went into myself and began to think about things, and I began to look at things, and I began to associate all of my background, my childhood background, with things that I had witnessed, the separation between people and the races. And I compartmentalized all of this stuff in a matter of a short period of time. And it was then that I began to see this, that I would have to take matters into my own hand, because it was at that time, I think, the seed began to grow in me to realize that America was a system of legalism. Don't get me wrong. I don't have a problem. You live in a society that should be legal. That should be laws governing action and so forth and so on. But America, in my opinion, I began in thinking, and I began to see that America went a step further. America not only had a system of legality, but America had deified legality and made it holy. In other words, if it was legal, it was deity. And I began to see, well, holy, wait a minute. It was legal to own slaves. It wasn't until the people saw slavery as being morally reprehensible that slavery, as we know in America, was, quote, abolished. And even then, it wasn't abolished. But I began to make these connections that legality and morality wasn't the same. You can't deify it no matter what you did. And I thought about slavery, all the people, hundreds of years in slavery, millions of people in slavery, and it was illegal. And so what I did when I was making all these associations, and I make no excuse for what I did one thing. I elected to use the law of the slave to rebel. I didn't have a legal right to rebel, but I had a moral right to rebel. And what I did, once I got 35 years, the only thing I regret is I didn't escape before I went to trial, and they found me guilty. But they had already done that. But I ended up writing my own, some people call it habeas corpus over there, but we refer to it when you escape as habeas escapers. And I written my own habeas escapers, and I escaped. And nobody got hurt. None of the people involved in this got hurt. I just wanted some freedom. I wanted out of prison. I wanted, because I was innocent of this particular crime. And I wanted out. Of course, one person who elected to go with me was killed. 10 or 11 of us made it, but they didn't get as far as I got. I was out for a little while. You know, I made it totally out of the prison. But someone recognized me, you know, and at that time, you could imagine how long this was. Someone dropped a nickel on me. That's a nickel. That's all it took to make a telephone call at that time. And someone dropped this nickel on me, called the police, and said I was in the neighborhood. Because when we escaped, it was like 20-some people. They say it was 12, but 20-some people tried to escape. Of course, there are 70 people or so on the tier. And I don't know why all 70 of them, because even though we didn't hurt anybody, we took over the jail. The jail was taken over that particular tier, and we opened the doors and let everybody out. And who wanted to get out. And of course, that was what I did then. That's the way I felt. That was my way of rebelling against slavery. And I make no bones about that. I don't apologize for that. If it would happen again, I would do the identical same thing again. At the time, it was my evolution anyway. I was evolving to a point where I felt this. I would attack anything that attacked me. If I was wrongly attacked, then I had to do something to reconcile that. You know, what happened, I did it at that time, and I have no regrets, and I escaped. And it was the beginning of an ordeal, because once I escaped, you know, the authorities saw me as, quote, a militant. And then it was after being rearrested that I was being held in isolation, that was mostly for, because we were being held in cells, 6x9x12-foot cells, and we were there in that cell 24 hours a day, maybe 10 minutes for a shower. But there was a television that was on the hallway. We could see it if we get close to the bars, because it was mesh wire, but we could hear it plainly. And it was sometime September 1971. 71, I believe it was. That was the first, what they called, no, maybe September 70. That was the first shootout between the New Orleans Black Panthers. I didn't even know that they were in New Orleans at the time. It was in September 1970, and that, it was, the newscaster, you know, broke into the cast that was on, the broadcast that was on, to say that there were a group of, quote, militants downtown in a night ward shooting it out with policemen. In a night ward, in a housing project. And that sort of arrested my attention. And I looked at that, and I called that, and then I listened to the news further, and they say that these are people, members of the NCCF, which meant at the time National Committee to Combat Fascism. I didn't know what fascism meant, but it sounded good to me. And then later on, it sounded good because it seemed like I was undergoing some form of fascism. But then later on, they say, well, these are members of the Black Panther Party, actual members of the Black Panther Party, and there were three females and there were nine males in the house, and they were shooting it out with the police. However, they call it a shootout. It was more like a shoot-in than a shootout. But those brothers and sisters, they resisted, and I really hope and wish, and I tried it, if some way I could have transported myself, you know, into that house down the ninth ward, I would have gladly done so. That was my evolution at that time. I would have gladly done so without a doubt. And had I died, it wouldn't have made a difference because it was my evolution at that time. On the other hand, it didn't happen. And I can say now, and which is another story, I'm glad it didn't, because if that would have happened, a lot of other things would not have happened. But this is, I just want to give you a juxtaposition of what it was that motivated me, that led me into believing what I believe. Doing the things that I did while I was in prison. After, you know, being rearrested and reapprehended, I met members of the Black Panther Party. I met some of the females who went to the House of Detention for Women. I also I communicated with those because they began to communicate with everybody in the prison. And then the brothers who was on C1 or on what they call a Panther tier at the time, they began to reach out to people, you know, around the prison. And it became almost like an education center, and people were attracted by it. And everybody didn't join the Black Panther Party. Everybody didn't empathize or sympathize with the Black Panther Party. But the Black Panther Party got attention from people, and everybody at the time really respected some of the things that they were doing. And I was no exception. And while the Black Panther Party was doing a lot of things, I wanted the freedom that it offered. You know, and I liked it, the philosophy. You say we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace, and as a major political objective, a United Nations supervised plebiscite, you know, to be held in throughout the black community in which only black people or black people will be allowed to participate for the purpose of determining the will of black people. We had no nothing determining the will of black people. We were under a constitution that was flawed, even though slavery was supposed to allegedly have been abolished, slavery really had not been abolished, not in the true essence. I mean, people, even today, you tell people the 13th Amendment didn't abolish slavery in America, and they look at you like you're ignorant or like you're crazy. And in all actuality, slavery, the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery in America, which is another story. They did not, because there's a clause in there that says, you know, slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist on these shores. And it goes on to say, except one who has been duly convicted of a crime. That clause, that exception to clause, makes slavery just as legal as it was before the so-called abolishment of slavery. And what it did was actually took back the Emancipation Proclamation that was written a few years earlier before the end of the war, that Lincoln had signed over to allow those people who fought against slavery to be freed. When the 13th Amendment came out, it eliminated that Emancipation Clause that gave freedom to all those black people who decided to fight for slavery. And so we were back under people who were under slavery, but not just black people, you all, because they made it possible for white people to go to jail too. When they say slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist except one who has been duly convicted of a crime, it means everybody who went to prison was subject to slavery. You know, it's just some people were subject to more slavery than others, depending on the color of your skin. Because even in prison, you know, there are, you know, different ways they treat people. But these are the things that, like I say, I begin to understand these type of things about this. And while I was in prison, we continued to, you know, to do things, you know, that shed light on our belief. We did things, even though we were in prison, we continued. We took the, you know, eventually I became a member of the Black Panther Party. They understood some of the things that I was doing. I met many of those members who were in jail at the time, and they decided that, you know, I could become a member of the Black Panther Party. But I must admit this and say to you, while I became a member of the Black Panther Party, which did not last that long, but the 7 years or so years that it lasted, it had a great impact, not just on America, but the world. But the fact is, I didn't become a member only of the Black Panther Party. I became a member of the struggle. I joined the struggle. And it was this struggle. You know, the Black Panther Party led me into a struggle, into a phase, you know, into a spirit of struggle that I know is unending. And because when you look at the historical nature of a society, when you look at the historical oppression of people who are most oppressed in that society, it doesn't matter unless that society reach a high standard. Someone will always be stepped on. Someone will always become a flow mat. It doesn't matter what the law say. The law can be beautiful. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men, you know, are created equal. Give me a break. You know, no. I mean, they don't go on to say that, well, some are more equal than others, and we are going to treat it like that. That is something that you really don't see. But that is the way it was, and that is the way it had been for me, and that is the way it is in most cases now. And so, you know, the struggle, as I say, continues. And I felt even at that time it continues. Herman and Alvin and I, they would not put us on a tier at the same time, but we all had the same concept. We all had the same mindset, and they understood that having this mindset, it could be dangerous.
You are listening to Robert King on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Robert King is a member of the Angola 3. He spent decades in solitary confinement in Angola, Louisiana.
But I need to say this to you. I was held in solitary confinement for 29 years, total 31 years, almost 32 years in prison. But I was held in solitary confinement 29 years, not for any crime that I committed. I was held in solitary confinement based on the fact that I wasn't even in prison. You heard Robin mention about, you know, the charges that we were charged with certain crimes. I was never, ever charged. Herman Alvin and two other people were charged in the crime of allegedly killing this correctional officer. And even though there was no evidence ever proven, Albert taking polygraph tests, everybody, all of them took polygraph tests, and the blood stain that they found didn't match no one. And I wasn't even in prison. I was 150 miles away, and the incident took place 2 weeks before I even got to prison. Nevertheless, they placed me on the investigation for 29 years into this particular crime. And 29 years was a long time to be on the investigation. All of this is public record. It is public. If you go to Wilkerson at the time, Wilkerson and all versus Maggio or Phelps and all the Department of Correction, all of this is record. And I was there even when I was released. I was charged eventually into the death of another inmate in which an officer witnessed this murder, testified during the first trial that he didn't see me do anything. I had people testify that I didn't do anything. The man who actually killed a guy in self-defense testified that I didn't have anything to do with it. However, nevertheless, I was still under investigation for the murder of this officer, and I was being held in solitary confinement for that duration of my time. It really wasn't until, you know, I began to do some research and do some own law work, file my own. Don't get me wrong, they had me in a place where I couldn't file habeas escapers, but I did file a habeas corpus, which had merits, and the federal court overturned my decision, my conviction based on that. In the course of that conviction got overturned 3 times before I was ultimately released from prison. And I was released from prison. And when I left prison, and we'd done some things, and I'll get into maybe the question and answer period if you want to ask questions about it. But when I left prison, you know, after that period of time, after my ordeal, and I left prison with the mindset that I didn't make any promise to anybody I didn't say what I would specifically do or what I specifically would not do. But I did make one proclamation that even though I was free from Angola, I stated that Angola would never be free from me. And since that time, I was released February 8, 2001. I've traveled at least 25 different countries. I've been to just about every college in every state talking about prison. We've won a lawsuit based on, at least in the Fifth Circuit, U.S. Code of Appeal, we won a suit based on solitary confinement. We challenged solitary confinement. And, you know, it's a lot of things that has happened since that time. The efforts that I have extend beyond Herman, Albert, and myself. You see me wearing a tag, free all political prisoners. I understand the connection between COINTELPRO, who targeted the Black Panther Party. I understand that the connection between them and prison today, and I also understand the overcrowdedness of prison that they have based, you know, on the concept of law. In other words, that the fact that you are guilty of a crime and the way they treat certain people who commit crime, when they could attach more significance to you based on your color, where a racist district attorney, you know, a conservative, a Republican thinking, sorry to say, district attorney can enhance your sentence. In other words, it means that a district attorney has an opportunity in the states. I don't know about here. They can, they have a power of indictment. They can either water a sentence down, or they could exacerbate it. They could, you know, they could embellish it. They could, you know, make it aggravated. And in most cases, if they're racist, they will give you the more aggravating term. They won't mitigate it for you if you're black. And historically, that's the way it has been. And this is the reason why it's so, one of the reasons why the place is so crowded, because unlearned people and unfeeling people who use the judicial system and use that system of slavery to actually enslave, and not just enslave. You've heard all of the, you know, the ramification from prison. They speak of, you know, private prison and so forth. And which is another factor that's involved in, but private prison is not the factor in the state. It is the biggest privateers of prison is the United States government. Wackenhut, Correction Corporation of America, and these other sub-entities that are considered private prison, it only amounts to maybe 250,000 or so prisoners. They don't account for the 80,000 prisoners who are held in solitary confinement, and that's a conservative estimate on a daily basis. They don't make up for that. They don't make up for all these people who are held. They say there are 4 million, or at least 2 million people in jail, and maybe another 2 million people on some supervision. But they don't tell you of the 30 or 40 or 50 thousand precincts that they have around the country on a daily basis. Those, you know, those precincts are filled with people. They got people all over America that are uncounted that are being held in prison. So all of this, this system of slavery, this system, this clause in the 13th Amendment make this possible. It also made it possible for J. Edgar Hoover to tell his FBI agent that the Black Panther Party was the biggest internal threat in the nation and that they should be eradicated by any means necessary. It didn't make a difference whether they committed crimes or not. If they were in prison, keep them in prison. Prison, federal, and even though J. Edgar Hoover was federal, he had nothing to do with the state complied with him, and they agreed with him that if they were in prison, Herman and Albert and myself are examples of this, and we were just a tip of the iceberg. We were lucky enough to get people around us to support us because we enough people were convinced that something was drastically wrong with our case. But our case, again, is just a tip of the iceberg. Something is drastically wrong with all of those cases. We got people in prison. Rochelle McGee been in prison for over 50 years in the state of California. He was, the Rochelle McGee, some of you who are the older group in here, which is not many, but some of you may have remembered Rochelle McGee. He was just happened to go to court on it here. He only had 7 years. He's in St. Quentin at the time. He only had 7 years at the time. But it so happened Jonathan Jackson, the youngest brother of George, young brother of George Jackson, 17 years old at the time, decided to go, you know, to go into Marin County, go into the prison and get his brother out of prison by any means necessary. In any event, he was killed. A dude was killed, I believe, and the district attorney was paralyzed. William Christmas was killed, and John, I can't think of his name, he was also killed. All of those people were killed that day, but Rushell McGee survived. He is still in prison. He has been, had hearing after hearing, time after time in court. The man have been to some of the worst prison in California, and he's still in prison. He has no way of getting out because legally he is barred from entertaining, even though you might find, you know, some innocent factor or facts that can free you. Once you are legally involved, you've had your chance to prove your innocence, you don't get any more chances. So this is another reason why we have to look when they say the criminal injustice system or justice system, whatever you want to call it, has to be rehauled and overhauled. This is one of the main reasons why, because there are people who are still in prison, in slavery, who are charged with crime that have been embellished, you know, by officials who are racist, or because they had the opportunity to do so, or because they just wanted to be prejudiced. And they are in prison, for all of these decades and all of these years. And I do think this, that it's time, you know, for people in the United States, and this has been Albert and my message. You know, Albert and my message has been, you know, to focus on political prisoners. In other words, there are many people who are in prison who does not deserve to be in prison, who were framed up to be in prison, but the law has just denied them the right to further open up or reopen any issues regarding their innocence, and they are still in prison. And then again, we talk about South Africa, we talk about Mandela, and not to mitigate or make anything less for him, but America has its own Mandelas. America needs to be some reconciliation within the prison system regarding America and its prisoners. If they want to reconcile, if they want to make up some of this difference, they need to go back and eradicate and erase some of the stuff that they did many, many years ago. And what we are trying to do is develop a language. We would like to have people, we would like to have lawyers, scholars, and anybody else who can write the language, construct the language, you know, and what we are trying to see and make this appeal. We are trying to make this a moral issue instead of a legal issue. We're trying to deconstruct the concept that legality is deity. We're trying to show that if anything going to be deified, let it be morality. I think that the decent, people are inhibited. They are born with certain decency. Of course, certain things happen in their life to bring certain, inequity qualities out in surface. But basically, people are decent people. And, you know, when I go on these excursions, when I travel to all these countries, when I travel around the world, around America, I don't knock the American people. It is the American system that is flawed. American people, there are some beautiful people in America. Of course, there are some unbeautiful ones, too. But basically, America, there are some beautiful people, and it cuts across the masses, cuts across races. So my indictment could never be against the American people. My indictment is against the flawed system of America. Our indictment, the thing that we have to do as activists in America is have to wage war against a flawed system, not against people. And if there are people that support a flawed system, then yeah, it extends to that. And so now our war goes beyond. People ask me today, you know, Donald Trump been elected, you know, president of the United. Okay, so what? If Hillary was president, I'd be doing the same thing. I'd be saying the same thing. Because the struggle goes on. It continues. It just have to, with Donald Trump, he remind me that nothing he can or anybody do will make me cease to struggle. He just reminded me that the struggle needs to continue. In any event, this is what I'll do. And when I left prison, I say that my struggle continues, and my struggle continues to this day, and Albert's struggle continues. Albert is not here for himself. He asked me to apologize. We'll be trying to call him in a little bit, and hopefully he can speak to you all. But he feels the same way. We are going back to get political prisoners, people who, not just political prisoners, because we live in a system that has a judicial system that is flawed, and it impacts everybody, whether you're black, white, gray, green, purple, or whatever you want to call yourself. It impacts everybody. It is a flawed system, and we want to focus on that, and this is our mission, and this is my quest. Thank you.
Presently 11:45 a.m. and you are listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
You know what they say, all good things come in threes. And April the 16th, this holy weekend, Easter Sunday's annual event is guaranteed sold out, just like every year. Mahogany Productions, Junior Nash, and Shamba presents Return of the Legends Part 3. April the 16th at Suite 55 in Dorval. Your DJs and party rockers for the night are live from Antigua, Mad Mixer LDG, along with local celebrity DJ Quite Sane, and that crazy man known as the Almighty Flight. These men have made it their mission to keep the bass in your face and rock you at a steady pace, bringing you the old school classics, new school hits, and today's club banging anthems, all happening now, April the 16th, at Suite 55, 2362 Hymas Boulevard, Dorval.
We'll end the show today with audio from the question and answer period that took place at the talk Robert King gave in Montreal. In this piece, King speaks about the justice system in the United States. He emphasizes the system is flawed. He then goes on to speak about the psychological impacts of solitary confinement and ends with a brief discussion of surveillance. You can find out more about the Angola 3 at angola3.org.
Well, I think it's important for us to go back and, to relate and to make people who were targeted for their political belief in people who are held in prison, because of their political belief, who was given insurmountable prison sentences not because they did anything wrong, morally wrong, that is, and they never were convicted of killing anybody or murder. They were only convicted of a crime in which were enhanced. They were targeted, and many of them weren't even convicted of crime in which they had committed, but they were targeted because they dared to struggle, against a system of repression. So I think it's important the system understand that people who are struggling against it, if they are the system come at them, you know, as a result, you know, reprisals in any way, that we are backing them, that they are soldiers fighting for people. They are fighting for rights. They're not in another country, you know, dropping bombs on people, waging war and killing other people and being killed. But they are nevertheless on the forefront fighting for justices, you know, that are within the criminal justice system that is really flawed. And for that reason, I don't think that they should spend the rest of their life. They should not have a death sentence. And like I say, we have people who struggle against this system, you know, years ago, and who are still in prison. They have a death sentence, not because they kill anybody and not because most of them done anything wrong. And the ones who have done something wrong, they'll pay their dues to society, but they're still being held, you know, not based on the crime, but for revenge reasons. And I think what we have to do is we have to make the system aware that we are aware that they're doing this, you know, to people, not, you know, because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the legal thing to do. It is because they feel that they have their due process. They feel that despite the fact that a jury might have found them guilty of, they went before a jury of their peers and they were found guilty of a crime. It doesn't say that these people are actually guilty because a jury of your peers say you were guilty. I had a jury of my peers say I was guilty. Wood Fox had a jury that said he was guilty of his peer. Herman also had a jury of his peer. How many people in the history of America is replete with people who have, you know, did 30, 40 years in prison only to learn that they had not committed the crime? Evidence surfaced that favorable evidence was suppressed in their case, and they are released. And some get an apology and some don't get an apology. I mean, so we have to look at the system as being flawed. We can't look at just because it's legal, it's okay. Again, you know, and I can't help but to keep emphasizing, many people say chattel slavery was okay. And it wasn't until people saw it as being morally reprehensible that people got rid of it. There's no difference between chattel slavery in prison. People are undergoing slave labor, big corporations, and corporations who have ties with the system, you know, who are the biggest privateers. They get contracts to go into prison, you know, and get mostly free labor, you know, underpaid employment to people who are in prison, who are there because the law say that you should be in prison and not because you done anything to get in prison morally. It's you're just there legally. And when they say you had due process, it doesn't mean that you were found guilty of the crime in which you committed. Due process only means one thing. They didn't violate any laws convicting you. And that is to show you the contradiction. That was in my case, when my case first got overturned, I had a magistrate, a federal judge, made the fact that I had made a showing of actual innocence. But there were no laws violated in convicting me. I could not believe that. A law was violated in convicting the innocent. But this judge here stated that even though I had made a showing of actual innocence, they didn't violate the law. In other words, due process wasn't violated. But that was, to me, that was what I needed. Because no judge prior before that time had stated that I had made a showing of actual innocence. And so I used innocence. I used the fact that this judge, even though he denied me and said that I didn't deserve, you know, this particular law that would have been applicable to me. The fact is this, that I went ahead and I kept filing, and I didn't believe him when he said that even though I had made a showing of actual innocence, I still should stay in prison. I felt that anyone in prison who's innocent should do what they can to get out of prison. And I used the law. I would have used other means. I just didn't have them. You know, I'm going to say things that people probably don't want to say or haven't got around to asking me. People ask me all the time, why aren't you crazy? I look at them. They asked me, why aren't you crazy? I would have went. I tell them, wait a minute, hold up. I did not tell you I wasn't crazy. You know, I don't believe no one could get dipped in waste and not come up smelling. It's impossible. And even though, you know, you may not see the physical scars or the physical effect, there are some psychological things that take place that is not, you can't touch. It's not tangible like everything else. For instance, like Albert have a problem, but he was here. He'll tell you he have claustrophobia is his thing. And mine is totally different. And I think each individual has a different experience. Mine is totally different. While claustrophobia, closed in places, impacts him, I think mine is, I think it's pronounced agoraphobia, wide open spaces. I have a, quote, a trepidation. Now, I ain't going to say a fear, but I have a trepidation sort of for wide open spaces. I get confused. And I imagine I had acclimated myself so much to being in a 6x9x12 cell that wide open spaces, I have a problem. Even though I grew up in New Orleans in neighborhoods, and even though the city has changed a lot, but there were places that I went to, that I grew up in, that I used to walk, tread around in, run around and play in, that I didn't even recognize. And even though they are still there, some are still there. It's just that solitary confinement impacts you. I went to University of Pittsburgh, and we were also in California, and we were in New York, and we were speaking the American Association of Scientists Against Solitary Confinement. They have started doing a yearly study and holding conferences on the impact of solitary confinement. The next one will be in Austin, Texas, sometime in the fall, in which I have also said that I will participate in. But I participated in the last three that they've had. And the academic, the solitary confinement, the impact of solitary confinement, its effect affecting the academic world. Like I say, scientists, sociologists, psychologists, you know, all of these people are on board, and they have, you know, come up with finding that solitary confinement, you know, and they say, of course, they say prolonged solitary confinement caused brain damage. But what is prolonged solitary confinement? Prolonged solitary confinement is being alone 1 hour in a cell. That's prolonged solitary confinement. Of being in a cell 24 hours, that is prolonged solitary confinement. The point is, it doesn't matter. I see some people who are in solitary confinement for 1 hour, and they are impacted the same way as I've seen others stay 5 years in solitary confinement. So it doesn't matter the length of time that you stay, whether it's 15 days, 15 hours, or 15 minutes, you know. If you are a human being used to living, and you are being sent, you know, if you undergo sudden deprivation, it can be devastating to the brain. The civilians of me is not unique, because we, like I said, I think we all are to some degree. Big Brother been here a long time ago. I'm telling you, a long, long time ago, even when they was telling us it was coming, it was already here. You know, so, and I don't mean to be curtis, short or anything, but we are on the surveillance. But do I feel personally that I'm being surveyed? Do I feel as if, you know, the government have a track on me? Well, yeah, of course they do. Because it's great, I've been to 20 different countries or more talking about the same thing. You know, of course they'll check it up on me. But so what? You know, what can they do to me? I mean, what more? I mean, they could knock me off the planet, and it's too late, because I'm going to be here even when they knock me off the planet. I'm leaving something here that they're going to understand and know about. So they're not going to get rid of me that easy. They could keep me under surveillance all they want to. I'm going to make sure they do. But I think it's important for us to go.
The time is presently 11:57, and you've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, April 13th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name's Noah, and I've been one of your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.
Again.